This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
We're recording just after the close today, March 31st. We're live on the Twitter Spaces again. We have not that many listeners today. It does seem that Twitter was a little bit slower today, not in terms of its speed. It was just, maybe it was a little quiet today. Maybe everyone's taking a well-earned break after the long quarter that we just had, or the volatile quarter. And are happy with their window dressing that they did today, and are ready to get out of the way and relax over the weekend.
Yeah. People are done with this whole March Madness theme and getting ready onto the April flowers, I guess. But with that, I guess we should give a nice little shout out here. Congratulations to Mr. Mark Kimbrough and Miss Maddie this weekend for their upcoming wedding here. I guess I'll be seeing you tomorrow, Jeff, on this one. So hopefully it'll be a good time. I'm pretty sure it will be. And hopefully everything goes well.
Well, we will make it a good time, Sam.
At least we'll have one.
Yes.
Let's see.
All right. You want to get into the where are we for the week, the month, and the quarter?
Yeah. Let's see here. I'm hearing that I might not be heard on Twitter Spaces here. Not sure what's going on. As you know, I'm a Luddite, but I do see that my mic is on. So
I can hear you. So let's roll. Let's roll with it.
All right. That sounds good. Let's get past this Crow Tech then and jump into where we are. So breakdown with, since we're at the quarter date, I'll skip for the most part the week to date across these things, focus more on the month to date and the quarter dates, which is also consistent with the year to date, I guess, there. But the S&P 500, a strong start to the year, up 7.5%. Year to date and quarter to date. The month was strong too. It sure didn't feel that way. You know, when we look back at some of the things that we've talked about on Monday Morning Minutes through these past few weeks for the month of March Madness here, but the S&P 500 is up 3.7% month to date. A lot of that coming this week to date, though, it's up 3.5%. And looking across the sectors underlying the S&P 500, all 11 sectors are in the green for this week to date basis. Month to date, the best performer was technology. On the flip side, that was up almost 11% on the month. On the flip side, the financials were the worst performer, down 10%. And as we look down into the regionals index here, it looks like that was the big drag on financials. That was down 21% on the month, down 18% on the quarter and year to date basis for the regional banking sector there. But flipping over to looking at the 11 sectors underlying the S&P 500, technology and communications both up over 20% on the year-to-date basis. Consumer discretionary is the third place finisher there, up 16%. And with that, given that they do contain some of the growthier names, when I look at the Russell 1000 growth versus the Russell 1000 value, growth is trouncing value here. Up 14% on the year-to-date basis, while the value index is up not even a percentage point for the year-to-date so far.
I mean, not even a percentage point. It's flat. We can call that flat for value.
Yeah. I mean, I see a 69 basis points right now. So I guess in that context, I would go flat for that as well. I'll be in agreement there with you, Jeffrey. But moving over to fixed income. little bit of excitement over there looking at the treasury curve. We were just talking about it before we started this segment, how much the yield on the two-year treasury note has moved on this kind of month-to-date basis, at least for the month of March. But right now, as we stand, the two-year treasury note has a yield of 4.03, so back above 4% on the yield for the two-year treasury. It's up 26 basis points on a week-to-date basis. But looking at it at the range, it's just really been incredible. On March 8th, when we recorded the podcast, or actually we recorded the podcast on March 10th, earlier in that week, the two-year note had hit a yield as high as 5.07 on the close. And as listeners recall, that was the week of the SVB fail, which was declared on that Friday, March 10th. And then we had Signature Bank fall along the way that weekend as well. So for listeners that want to kind of get caught up on the SVB and some of this banking crisis that I'll front run us here and we're going to be talking a little bit about today, can do so by listening to, I believe it's the March 10th podcast that Jeff and I have here. But anyway, so the high of 5.07 that March 8th, and then we got down to 3.77 on the yield for the two-year last Friday. So a bit of a roller coaster here as we look at it, and it's just making me a little nauseous when I take a look at the chart here at the two-year treasury as well. But moving down the curve here on the 10-year treasury for the first quarter, we have a closing yield of 3.5% and 3.7 on the long bond there. All of this is to say that over the past week, it looks like the inversion between the spread between the 10-year yield to the two-year treasury note is a little bit more inverted now. It's down to negative 56 basis point inversion relative to the 40 basis point inversion that we had the week prior. All of this meant that the Bloomberg bond aggregate is ending up with a negative week-to-date basis return of negative 50 basis points, but still with a plus sign in front of the return for both the month-to-date and the quarter-to-date basis. Month-to-date, it's up 2.6%. And quarter to date, as well as year to date, the ag is up about 3.25% there.
I thought it was interesting, Sam. The as you noted, the 2-10s curve, you know, we're kind of back to where we were at the beginning of the year at negative, you know, 55, 56 basis points. So, you know, kind of at a 40 basis point rally in interest rates. And so, even given all the turmoil and everything that's been going on, you know, just what we would say, it's a bull move down in rates. No steepen, no flatten, just a parallel shift, which normally doesn't happen over, you know, extended periods of time.
Yeah, you brought my eye to that. It's just to the basis point, the exact same level. So pretty interesting there. Looking across the sectors within the fixed income universe that we have access to, looks like on a quarter-to-day basis, clean sweep, everything in the green. Leading the way is, looks like the IG corporate credit market up almost 5% on a year-to-date basis. The laggard here is going to be agency mortgage-backed securities, up only 2.75% for the quarter and the year-to-date. Month-to-date, we have one laggard, and that's going to be in the bank loan sector. That's pretty much, I guess you can call it flat using that what we're talking about there with the value sector. But the bank loans are down 5 basis points as it stands on the index on a month-to-date basis. So pretty strong showing across both equities as well as the fixed income sectors, both on the year-to-date basis, but also a very strong showing for the month, but which again, just is a little bit of a head scratcher in terms of the sentiment, right? How we felt talking about these things over the past few weeks here in March Madness. Glad to see it coming to a close, but also glad to see that it was a strong period as well.
I mean, I guess all is well.
No
bank concerns. You know, we went out on a pretty strong move there in the S&P at the end of the day. So, mission accomplished, I guess, by the Fed.
Yeah,
at least on the bank run front, inflation front, TBD.
It almost feels like a little bit of that hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil kind of thing, where there's a little bit of earmuffs going on and blinders being put on. But we'll see, you know, what the second quarter and the second half of the 2023 have in store. Perhaps it's just the beginning of some cracks in the system, but time will tell. So moving over to, let's see here, commodity land, the Bloomberg commodity, broad basket of commodities, the index there is up 2.5% on the week. But on a quarter-to-date basis, it's still down over 5%. It's definitely the laggard within the broad sectors of the financial market, or asset sectors of the financial market that we cover here. But looking at it, WTI crude oil had a nice bounce this week. It's back over $70. In fact, it's got a $75.59 on the front month futures of the WTI contract. That puts it up over 9% on a week-to-date basis. But having started out the year with an 80 handle on a price for barrel of crude oil, that puts it down almost 6% on a year-to-date basis, despite the strong showing this past week here. Looking at gold couldn't stay above $2,000 a troy ounce. I saw that it popped there on an intraday basis a few times. It might have even managed to close here or there, but it wasn't able to maintain it. Right now, as it stands, it's at about $1,970 a troy ounce. Still up 8% for a year, but I looked at the chart earlier today and saw that it looks like the pet rock, or at least Kimbrough's pet rock here, is within spitting distance of its all-time high that it reached at about $2,052 a troy ounce that it got to back in the 2020 of the pandemic year there. So it's getting there pretty close there, but it hasn't been able to reach it or breach it at this point. And then finally, you know, looking at Bitcoin here, Bitcoin is just over 28,000 a coin, up 3% on the week, up a whopping 72% on the quarter and year to date basis, being helped along by a positive 23% performance for the month of March. So that wraps us up.
As we would like to say, Sam, annualize that.
Yeah, that'd be a great number to annualize there if we lived in that kind of world. So with that, that's the wrap up of the markets for the week, month, and year and quarter. Do you want to kick us off on what happened in the macro land?
Yeah, it was a pretty quiet week. On Tuesday, we did get the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Home Price Index numbers. If we look at the 20-city month-over-month number, it came in negative 0.4%. It was expected to come in at negative 0.5%, so slightly above estimations there. That brought the year-over-year numbers to a positive 2.5%. So, you know, we're starting to see some continued slowdown here. We do have a couple more months of positive returns or positive price moves the next 2 months. And so if we get past those and if we continue this trend that we had like a negative 0.4 today or for this past month, we'll go negative in terms of year over year prices in a couple of months there. If you look at the broad, so instead of the 20 city one, look at the broad home price index, that's actually up higher of 3.8%. Which kind of would make sense given that the cities tended to be up a lot more than the broad index kind of at the peak. And so you would expect the cities to decline faster than the broad number. We did on Thursday get the jobless claims numbers. As usual, initial jobless claims came in at 198,000. That was only 2,000 more than the estimate. And continuing claims came in actually a little bit below estimates at 1.689 million people. It was estimated to be 1.7. So continued strong labor market there from those weekly claims numbers. And then today we got the personal income and personal spending. Personal income came, this is for February. Personal income came in at 0.3%, just slightly above the 0.2% estimate. And spending came in a tenth or 0.1% below its 0.3 estimate at 0.2. So pretty much as steady as she goes there. Maybe people are, you know, savings ticked up a little bit. So maybe people are maybe starting to tighten their belts or hoard a little bit of money because of, you know, maybe it's the coming recession, or maybe that's because they realize that they can buy T-bills for 5% instead of 0% on their checking account. So they're saving a little bit more. We also got the PCE numbers this morning. That's the Fed's preferred inflation gauge. If you look at the PCE deflator month over month, came in at 0.3%, right on expectations. The year-over-year number was 5%, 5 flat, just slightly below the 5.1 expectations there. So still a long way from, it's flattening out, but not too much disinflation there, as Chair Powell would like to say. We look at the core numbers. So this is the Fed's preferred inflation gauge. The year-over-year core came in at 4.6, was expected to be 4.7, so slightly better there. That's because the month-over-month number came in at 0.3 instead of the 0.4 that was estimated. If we break it down even further, we look at the number that Chair Powell has talked about a lot in over the past couple of Fed meetings, the PCE core services number, less housing, is estimated that, you know, that's not an official number, but Bloomberg calculates this number, and they say that number came in at 4.6% year over year, 0.3% month over month. That's a flat number from last month on a year over year basis. So as Chair Powell said, this is kind of the one area of the inflation fight that hasn't moved and hasn't really moved into disinflation, and that continued. So I think if we didn't have that bank run issue we had earlier this week, we would be now pricing in more Fed rate hikes, because this number just is not coming down at all. And then finally, this morning, we also got the University of Michigan 5 to 10 year inflation expectations number. It actually ticked up from 2.8, or it was 2.8. It was expected to be 2.8, ticked up slightly to 2.9, but really still nothing to see here. And unless it kind of ticks above that three level, then I think that Chair Powell will ignore it, not bring it up, and not really bring any attention to it. So, you know, as is typical, when the numbers suit him, he'll bring them up again. We shift our attention to the balance sheet, the Fed's balance sheet numbers that came out yesterday. The discount window, that number fell $22 billion to $88 billion. And in the BTFP number was actually up $11 billion to $64 billion. So now we're like 2.5 weeks in. It seems like that number is still pretty small, $64 billion. I would have expected that to be a little bit higher. Perhaps there isn't really that much of a demand for it. And maybe it's much more of the case of, because the banks know it's there, that they feel more comfortable not using it. But net, you know, if you take this discount window down 22, BTFP up 11, net, that was a down $11 billion there on the Fed balance sheet. Slight, you know, slight difference there. The borrowing at the foreign repo, which was presumed to be the Swiss National Bank, actually fell $5 billion to $55 billion. And then the FDIC borrowing, which is makes up the bulk of that Fed balance sheet change that we've talked about over the past couple of weeks, that number was unchanged on the week. So, you know, a slight downtick there in the Fed balance sheet overall. We move over to Fed speak for the week. If we look at the interest rate probabilities right now, just refreshed it, and we're at a 58% chance of a 25 basis point hike on the May 3rd Fed meeting. We're still pricing in a 4.35 implied rate at the end of the year. So 50 basis points lower from here. So, you know, it looks like the Fed's going to hike, you know, if they follow the probabilities, Fed hike in May and then cut three times before the end of the year. So it was something, Sam, you and I had pointed out a few podcasts ago, that it's not uncommon for the Fed to hike and then, you know, 2 months later start their cutting regime. So usually that's on the back of some sort of crisis. But the market's kind of pricing that into its into what it thinks is going to happen for the rest of the year. And if we kind of go, there was a lot of Fed speak this week. I'm just going to kind of highlight three speakers. Kash Kari was out there, and you know, the one headline I picked from him was, he said that the Fed's credibility would be at stake if we change the 2% inflation goal. And as we've talked about, Sam, can't change it higher now when they're struggling to get to that 2% inflation goal. It's really that would strain credibility. So they need to get it closer to that, you know, get at least that 2 handle before they talk about changing that inflation goal. Collins came out today. This was this morning. She said the PCE number was, quote, about what was expected, or as we like to say, as expected. And she said that she is highly data dependent. And then Williams came out from the New York Fed. He said the magnitude, duration, and the duration of the bank turmoil impact is uncertain, which we all know. Inflation has moderated, but still well above 2%, which we just talked about. And he expects inflation to fall to around 3.25% in 2023. So presuming that he's talking about core PCE core, we're going from 4.6 to 3.25 in the next 9 months. Seems pretty far-fetched, but I guess it really depends on this bank turmoil and if it's how much tightening is doing to the lending standards and whether it's doing the Fed's job for it.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of data points too between now and May 3rd, which is the next meeting. So yeah, I always get a kick out of people that are just saying how they're kind of dead set against or they already have their mind made up about the next move, you know, about the next meeting without looking at the data. Yeah. So it's always interesting to take note who those individuals are relative to the data dependency aspect that Jay Powell tries to tout.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. If the inflation comes in hotter, guess what? You're probably going to have a higher probability of raising rates. And if inflation comes in weaker, then you feel like, okay, they're restrictive enough. But that obviously, well, that's why we keep an eye on all the inflation and the macro pictures every week.
That's right.
All right, let's move over to our topic of the week. And we got a question from a repeat listener, Charles. He said that anyone remembers from last year, and I looked it up, and it was the April 1st meeting or April 1st podcast from last year, so almost exactly 1 year ago. He asked us a question regarding the real rates and the slope of the curve. And he's a listener from France. So hopefully, Charles, you've caught up on all, 50-ish episodes that we've done since then. But he wanted to know about, the reason why we chose to answer this topic this week is that it's a pretty wide ranging and people think this is pretty high or top of mind for people. And it's, he wants to know about the kind of the regional banking crisis or the turbulence going on. And, that over the past few years, a lot of the regional banks, the smaller banks have done a lot of commercial real estate lending and a lot of their, he claims, or he said, he, posits as the idea that a large portion of their assets are in mortgage-backed securities. And then a lot of it is the remainder of their balance sheet is in these commercial loans. And that if there's no loan growth on these regional banks and on the CRE, on the commercial lending side, it's going to have a pretty large impact on the overall economy. And if we get a slowdown in the economy because there's no lending going on and you're getting hit on the commercial real estate market, how is that going to affect the bank's balance sheets? How are we going to, and how, what kind of, what is our thoughts and what do we think about knowing that we're big participants in the structured credit markets? How do we think that, how do we view that mortgage or the CMBS market or CRE market? And so Sam, why don't you take us away and we'll see what kind of research we found in talking to our portfolio managers.
Yeah, that sounds good. I guess first and foremost, just wish Charles well over there in France. Hopefully he's staying safe with all the, the various anti-pension reform protests that have been going on there over the past few weeks. So stay safe out there, Charles, and let's get into it. But as we usually do, let's provide a backdrop here. And we focus primarily on the CRE side, since that seems to be where most of the chatter is about. So given the backdrop here for the CRE loan universe, at least in the US, a lot of the information is available on the Federal Reserve site. There's a wealth of data there and it's updated quarterly. So I guess we should be seeing the first quarter numbers come up fairly shortly. I won't say soon because it is the government. So there's probably going to be a little bit of a lag with the turnover there. But per the Federal Reserve site, commercial banks hold just over $2.8 trillion in commercial real estate related loans on their balance sheets. And again, this is all commercial banks, not just the smaller, the regional banks versus the large banks, but all commercial banks, again, just about $2 trillion in commercial real estate related loans. And that accounts for about 13% of the total on the bank's total balance sheet there, but it represents 25% of all the loans outstanding within the asset side of their balance sheet. So within their CRE is definitely a big chunk, but right alongside it are CNI loans, which stands for commercial and industrial loans, largely loans to small businesses, and then also residential loans, which are mortgages there for homeowners. And those were also big portions of the overall loan portion of the balance sheet, each one representing over 20%. So the biggest one by far was the 25% based on commercial real estate loans as a percentage of total loans, but you also have the other sides there, each over 20%. Breaking out this data into trying to disaggregate into small versus large banks here, roughly 70% of all CRE loans that are held by banks are owned by small, aka regional banks there. So that puts that of that 2.8 trillion, 70% at just shy of $2 trillion that's going to be held by the regionals there on the balance sheets. Within that, commercial real estate loans comprise 40% of all loans that are held on regional banks' balance sheets versus, as comparison, 13% of all loans relative to the large banks there. So that's kind of the context for which the discussion today and, you know, as well as within the industry is going about. But for insights into how DoubleLine is approaching this and thinking about this, we went to Morris Chen, who heads up our commercial real estate team here at DoubleLine. And his thoughts were this. He was saying that within the total universe, $2.5 trillion is set to come due over the next 5 years for commercial real estate loans. So the options there for that $2.5 trillion, as they always are, you can pay it off, which isn't usually the case. Typically, people look to refi. So there's a payoff, there's a refi, or it could default. The loans themselves can be defaulted, or they could be modified. So I guess that's what's top of mind today. Which path will borrowers take as a, you know, based on the context of this banking situation that we have today? So within that $2.5 trillion that's coming due over the next 5 years, when we take a look at it, it's almost pretty closely broken out to be about a $500 billion maturing each year. So in the next 2 years, we have $500 billion in 2023 and 2024 coming due. And given their outsized footprint in the space, if regionals were forced to either, you know, involuntarily, or if they're voluntarily to cut lending, then his impression is just, you know, naturally that the cost of financing is going to go up for borrowers seeking capital, both on new deals or if they're looking to refinance. So this goes well beyond the impact that, you know, Jeff, you and I, we've been talking about over the last year, what, you know, the cost of financing going higher just via the cost of higher treasury yields and the spread above that. But this really takes into account this idea of risk-based lending, taking the front seat in determining financing costs for loans going forward. And this assuming if a loan is extended or refinanced, it's just going to lead to a higher cost of funding. And really what it comes down to is these regional banks are going to take more of a magnifying glass approach and deal with borrowers requesting new capital, making it more of a case-by-case basis. So this can potentially pose a problem for anyone that needs financing in, let's say, the next 12 months, assuming that the issues that we've been talking about around regional banks continue down this path, but then resolve themselves within a year. But Morris thinks it's better to take a more conservative approach and think that, you know, in terms of us stressing the scenarios, that 24 months before this issue resolves itself is probably the more conservative window to look at it from that framework. So again, $500 billion of CRE lending is coming due this year, with another $500 billion in 2024 if you want to take the more conservative approach when you're doing your modeling. Outside of refinancing, though, there are other avenues that borrowers have. They can either look for loan modifications or loan extensions. And there's also the idea of the strategic default, which we've seen a few headlines around, this notion of selectively defaulting on loans within the office space. I'm not going to test compliance by bringing up any names here, but they have been in the headlines there over the past month or two. But I think that, in conjunction with what we're talking about today, really points to problems that we've been seeing in this space, commercial real estate, especially arising around vacancies. There's been talk of overbuilding of commercial property, particularly in urban centers. And then also this notion of work from home. There are a number of issues that have been building up for some time now, and they're really just starting to show themselves, you know, one after another. It's been kind of a slow build here, but bringing it back to the idea of modifications and defaults, Morris had one statement that said that it doesn't necessarily mean that banks are going to liquidate their loan portfolio based on that classification, because there has been some precedent to amending bank rules during the pandemic. So just in the last 3 years or so, loans that needed to be modified didn't necessarily force a default during that period. They were still allowed to be held on balance sheet by the banks without having them to reclassify as being defaulted and thus be a candidate for sales. There were these emergency measures that were enacted during that pandemic period, but that aren't necessarily in place now. But there is that precedent, and there's the possibility that they can be reenacted in some form or fashion there. But let's just say, on, again, you know, the more conservative side, if the rules don't change, this time around, then it's possible you could see, or likely that you probably see, that forced selling by regionals who are either unable or unwilling to refinance a loan. It seems to be that the money center banks, the larger ones out there, again, I'm not going to mention names, but those should be able to roll or refinance loans if they feel the inclination to do so. But bring it back to regionals, not all the regionals are facing the same issue that SVB and Signature face, because recall, as we talked in the March 10th episode, a lot of the issues that were faced there were, I don't want to say unique, but it had the characteristic of being, you know, fast-growing depositor base, or fast-growing deposits, I should say, but somewhat chunky depositor bases as those two banks seem to have. And, you know, as Morris mentioned, this will largely be a case-by-case type of analysis that's going to be required. Regionals will be likely, will likely refinance loans for borrowers that they believe to show good prospects for future repayment there. So it's not all or nothing here. There will be likely to see some refinancing still continuing, even at the regional level. But overall, the bottom line from Morris is that the cost of capital has increased and will likely continue to increase as regional borrowers or regional lenders are feeling some pressure there. One thing is refinances is not going to be as cut and dry as previous years. It's not that they're just rubber stamped, but they're the hurdle rate was probably much lower there. So with that, you know, the reduction in potential refis there, it's likely that we'll see higher rates of modification to loan terms. And unfortunately, we're probably likely to see, you know, higher than what we've been experiencing level of defaults. And the defaults in the commercial real estate spaces thus far has been fairly low, in the low single digits there. So, but there is possibility for that to increase as some of this banking stress hits the regional side. But I think that modification and extension is likely to be a theme in the quarters to come. Again, we've already heard talk about this as early as a month or two ago with some of the more heavier headlines that we've seen around the bigger names out there in commercial real estate. But all this means is that the can is going to get kicked down the road further. It's kind of something that we saw during the global financial crisis area for the residential mortgage space. We saw a little bit of that again in the pandemic, where there is the modification of loans, not only in residential, but this time also in commercial, during that 2020, 2021 period, especially. So I guess he did highlight one other option that the banks have would be to sell the assets kind of preemptively, not necessarily just a for sale, but taking a look to see if they could sell an asset at a price that they find reasonable. But in today's market, that likely means taking a slight hit relative to where they're being marked. But as always, you know, these types of things, when it comes down to these types of situations, when it comes to investing in the sector, it's an evolving situation, but, you know, there are ways to navigate it. It's not that, you know, Morris being in this space, you know, listening to all the headlines, reading all the headlines, that he's just, you know, just sees it as a no-win situation. There are ways to navigate around it. And oftentimes these situations present a buying opportunity for those teams that can properly sort out the noise and identify assets that are mispriced. And it just all boils down to having a team that conduct that due diligence that's required to underwrite and analyze both the credit as well as the cash flows there. So the thing is, in today's market, as you and I have been talking about, Jeff, and others on our team have been talking about, you know, we're fortunate to have a treasury market that's throwing off a relatively attractive yield. So you can, you know, you can get that flight to safety component in your overall portfolios. You're getting paid for it from a decent yield, and it's there to really offset the exposure that you might take on in credit.
Yeah, and I think, and that makes sense. And, you know, as obviously it could be a crucial piece to a portfolio, and, you know, as we like to point out, you know, a diversifier away from corporate credit. A couple of things that you know, I was thinking about while you were going over it is that there's certainly a lot of headline risk in the commercial space or the CRE space. You know, every time you see a story about a downtown LA office building, there's not that many of them. So, you know, you kind of, like, at least when I'm reading the story, like, my mind goes instantly to the building. I know where it is just because there's, you know, there's a dozen or, you know, a couple dozen buildings. And so It's pretty easy, you know, that kind of, you know, as we've liked to talk about, Sam, that narrative sticks in your mind. You can, when you can picture that office building, maybe it just seems like things are worse because it's not some office building that you don't know about. It's one that you can just picture in your mind. And then also, certainly, if the CRE or CMBS space becomes a bigger issue on the bank's balance sheets, how fast do you think the Fed would change the collateral of the BTFP program to accept you know, those types of loans or those types of mortgage-backed securities? So you know, it's always they can use that the 13-3 provision and kind of make things shift things around to how they would want it to be to stabilize the market.
Yeah, and I suspect, you know, as we've seen recently too, as I mentioned that Morris talked about, is back in the pandemic, you know, there were some changes to these kind of rules. You know, rules aren't necessarily meant to be broken, but rules can be changed, right? That type of situation where the accounting treatment can differ over periods based on these emergency measures here. So, you know, there's already whispers of that going on. And, you know, to be honest, it's they're not confirmed yet, but it's not too surprising if we go down this path again. It's not something to hang your hat on, but again, I think it just comes back to understanding the property types that you're in, understanding the properties themselves and, you know, the cash flow, and just understanding, you know, having that intimate knowledge in terms of being able to analyze these things.
Yeah. So we're not looking at imminent pricing falling off a cliff. So don't need to sell. Let's kind of wait and see and work things out. See how things work out, I should say.
Yeah. So we'll continue to monitor this and we'll update as we see new information come out that we think is relevant.
Yep. And thank you again for the question, Charles. We'll move on to the things to keep an eye on for next week. On Monday, we do get the ISM ISM manufacturing number for March. That is expected to be 47.5, down from 47.7 last month. So still in contractionary for the overall economy. On Tuesday, we get the JOLTS job openings for February. That number is estimated to be 10.45 million, down from 10.8 million. So maybe that would seem a little bit more of what Jay Powell wants to see, a little bit softening in the labor market. Wednesday, we do get the ISM services number. So we get manufacturing on Monday, services on Wednesday. That number is estimated to be 54.5, down from the 55.1 last month, but still above 50. So expansionary there on the services side. Thursday, as is typical, we get the jobless claims numbers expected to be flat. And then Friday is an interesting day. The stock market is closed. We do get, you know, for the Easter holiday, I believe, I don't know if it's Easter or Good Friday, what they call it, but the stock market is closed on Friday. The bond market is closed, or the bond market is open, but it's not even open, you know, the normal till 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. or 10 a.m. Pacific, but it closes at 9 a.m. Pacific for some reason. And the reason was that we do get, it is Pizza Friday, the first Friday of the month. And we do get the non-farm payroll number. So the bond market is open for a few hours to kind of trade the payroll numbers, and then closes early for the weekend. So I think Sam, because it is a holiday, we'll be recording on Thursday and probably at 10 a.m. Pacific, just so that people aren't trying to tune in here before the long weekend. But as you were saying just right now, you're rambling. I'm rambling now. So let's go payroll numbers next Friday. 5:30 a.m. Pacific, expected to be 240,000. Prior month was 311,000, so a slight downtick, but still still positive and still above that kind of 200,000 level that we kind of look at for a strong labor market. The U3 unemployment, 3.6%, kind of flat versus last month. Labor force participation rate, 62.5%, again, flat from last month. So short week, busy week, lots of data points out there, and you know, hopefully over that long weekend, there's no more bank failures.
Yeah, that's right. And those darned bond people, right? Forces people to work at that partial day, right? Just get a few hours in. So,
well, we used to be that bond people would take a half day before every holiday, but that got, you know, that got written off back in the early parts of my career. But it used to be very much that it was a nice to have a half day before every holiday. You kind of got an extended long weekend.
Yep, that's right. So
All right. Well, that wraps it up for this week, Sam. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in, both on the podcast and on the Twitter spaces.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone, for listening to us out there today. And thanks again, Charles, for the question there. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. And if you have any questions like Charles did that you want to submit, go ahead and send us an email at minutes@doubleline.com, or you can hit us up on the Twitter at DLine Minutes.
Yeah, and don't forget our website, doubleline.com. YouTube channel is youtube.com/doubleline capital. We uploaded a bunch of videos this week. We have Ken Shinoda's appearance on the Julia LaRoche Show podcast, Jeffrey Gundlach on CNBC, Jeffrey Sherman on Bloomberg TV, on Fox Business. I knew that wasn't right. It was Fox Business. And then we also have the most recent episode of The Sherman Show, where Jeff and Sam talked to Jen Wing from GeoWealth. Make sure to follow Jeff and Sam on their Twitter there at Sherman Show Pod. Hope everyone has a great short week and a great weekend.
Yeah. And then just one other thing here. I was just reminded that we do have a relevant video on the YouTube as well, where Morris Chen offers his thoughts on the commercial real estate side on our product specialist perspectives format of the YouTube station. Him and Phil Joy are out there talking commercial real estate. So Charles, that might be another way for you to get some more information around it from the person himself. But with that, thanks everyone for tuning in and good luck out there.
Represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the expressed written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates make any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2023, DoubleLine Capital.